This coming Thursday, Sue and I begin our annual trek to Tucson. And when I drive to get there, I usually try to go south through Virginia and then through the Carolinas and then cut across in the southernmost states going west. I prefer this to the more direct route through the Midwest, partly because of the weather, though that's never a guarantee, and as I have mentioned before, partly because of my own fascination with the South, including the Civil War. I usually go to at least one major Civil War site. It's the fascination that gets me there, but every single time I walk or drive through a site, I find myself completely and utterly repulsed by the horror. And I've often wondered where I would have stood. Would I have bought into the notion that this was all about states' rights? Or would I have seen the underlying reality that this is really about slavery and economics? And had I been a Unitarian minister, would I have encouraged our youth to enter the Union Army and fight and die for a cause to oppose slavery? Or would I have been a pacifist, knowing that our moral obligation was nevertheless to fight injustice? Would I have had the courage to stand up for what was clearly pernicious and reprehensible? In the years leading up to the Civil War, Unitarians were often divided on the issue of the abolition of slavery. In William Ellery Channing's congregation, for example, a significant percentage of the membership owned businesses that depended heavily on Southern slave labor. And so Channing found it difficult to speak out publicly in favor of abolition without jeopardizing his position in the pulpit. When at last he did, he found his role as a religious authority challenged by those members who were invested in the slave trade, and he was frequently shunned in public. In contrast, his friend Theodore Parker led a thriving congregation in the same city, this is Boston, by the way, in the same city while being an ardent and vocal abolitionist. It's easy to think that the South was the culprit when it came to slavery. But northern states were just as complicit, as the story of Channing suggests. But this became even more evident to me when I read the story of a man by the name of Thomas DeWolfe. 14 years ago, Thomas DeWolfe read a letter from a relative. It was an invitation to participate in a rather strange journey, as well as in a documentary film, which would later be called Traces of the Trade. Although he lives in Oregon, DeWolfe traveled in 2001 to Rhode Island, where he met 9 distant cousins and discovered that he was related to the most successful slave trading family in American history, responsible for transporting at least 10,000 Africans to the Americas. His infamous ancestor, U.S. Senator James DeWolfe of Bristol, Rhode Island, curried favor with President Jefferson to continue in the trade after it was outlawed. When James DeWolfe died in 1837, he was the second richest man in America. Thomas DeWolfe tells of his journey with his relatives in his memories called Inheriting the Trade. And this journey starts both literally and perhaps for him spiritually, in Bristol, Rhode Island, where these cousins met each other and talked about what they knew of their family history and of slavery. They went to the waterfront in Bristol, where they looked upon an old stone warehouse and a remodeled brick building bought in 1795 by one of the DeWolfe brothers, and learned that it was, in fact, one of the most important maritime sites in New England, for the brick building became a DeWolfe distillery. Molasses was imported from Cuba and then made into rum, which became the staple for the Triangle slave trade. And the warehouse itself was where one of the brothers reportedly kept slaves shackled to the walls. The triangle trade had to do with the business dealings from Bristol to West Africa, Cuba, and the American South. It was also from Bristol that the De Wolfs financed 88 voyages, which transported approximately 10,000 Africans. The De Wolf family was accountable for almost 60% of all African voyages sailing from Bristol, making them the largest slave trading dynasty in early America. The closest competition was two firms from Newport, Rhode Island, that each sent out 22 vessels. There is no sign when you enter Bristol, Rhode Island today that says, "You are entering Bristol, the historic center of the U.S. slave trading." And yet that is what it was. And there are no signs in Rhode Island or in any part of New England that admits that New England as a whole was instrumental, perhaps even more so than the American South, in the institution of slavery on this continent. It was interesting to me as well that when we had our General Assembly in Providence a couple of years ago, we discussed, as usual, anti-racism and multicultural diversity. But to my knowledge, we never talked about the prominence of slavery as it related to the historical and geographical area in which we were meeting, and what that might all mean to us. The slave trade was outlawed in 1808. And yet for another 12 years, there was a vigorous clandestine slave trade that continued to operate out of Bristol, Rhode Island. For over 200 years, black people were enslaved in the North. The vast majority of all slave trading in America was done by Northerners. Remarkably, half of all North American voyages involved in the slave trade originated in Rhode Island, and all the northern states benefited. Now, I suspect that most of us didn't learn this in our history classes. So we're willing to talk about our European ancestors' annihilation of the native peoples in New England and the Northeast, but little is discussed about northern responsibility for the entire slave trade. So now when I go to a Civil War site, I still wonder about slavery in the South and what it must have been like. But I also wonder how implicated the North was with regard to institutionalized slavery, particularly New England, where I grew up and lived most of my life. And I suspect that it goes far deeper than I can even imagine at the moment. It is easy to blame the South. It is easy to proclaim the northern liberal white desire for racial justice. It may not be so easy, however, to see our own past and our own part as privileged whites in the varied forms of institutionalized racism, even today. If racial healing is ever to occur, then we can't engage in constructed amnesia about the domestic institution of slavery, of the slave trade in New England. Nor can we dismiss the economic implications regarding unbridled capitalism. As one professor who studied slavery notes, the root of slavery is in capitalism. Slavery disappeared when slaves were no longer necessary to the financial success of the plantations. Thomas De Wolf and his cousins went on the second leg of their journey by going to the country of Ghana on the coast of Africa. Although slavery was an African issue, since Africans enslaved Africans and sold them to Europeans for rum, weapons, and other commodities, it was Europe who established the slave castles along the coast of Africa and greedily sucked dry whatever resources Africa could provide. The violent conquest of the African continent was a naked competition among European nations for colonies and resources with almost total disregard for the needs and desires of the conquered Africans. And the 10 relatives of Captain James De Wolf visiting two of the slave castles and other historical sites, found evidence of their relatives being in Ghana. "We sit here," says Professor Kofi Anyadoho from the University of Ghana, talking to the Dwolf clan at Cape Coast Castle. And he continues, "The breeze is wonderful, and I wish we could just relax and forget about what has brought us here. But this was the room in which the patrons did business. In this room. This was where African people were sold into slavery. When we refer to this place as a castle, it was indeed a castle for the people who did business in this room. But not so for the thousands upon thousands of African men, women, and children who were placed in dungeons within the castle and let out through one door known as the Door of No Return to the ships that would transport them to the New World. It is estimated that 10 to 15 million Africans landed alive in the New World. But every slave who arrived in the Americas represented others who died in Africa or during the Middle Passage. Between the point of capture, transportation to the slave forts, being held in the dungeons, and then above all, the way they were transported across the Middle Passage, packed so tight it was practically impossible to walk through them, many people were lost. The Atlantic slave trade lasted approximately 425 years, beginning in 1441 with the Portuguese. Thomas DeWolf writes in his memoir, "Cape Coast Castle is whitewashed, just like the history books from which I was taught in school. So this is where the African diaspora began, the African Holocaust. Why have I not heard about this before? I imagine ships from Bristol arriving here. Our ancestors rowed ashore in canoes like the one I now see a few hundred feet past the waves. They walked these steps, sat on these walls, negotiated in these rooms, and traded rum for African people. They were here, and I feel them. How can I begin to understand the horror that African people have suffered? How do you clean a 1,000-year-old wound?" The third leg of the journey for the DeWolf relatives was Cuba. Although at that time the U.S. embargo against Cuba complicated travel arrangements, they managed to arrive in Havana, where they visited the port, which was once one of the largest slave markets in the world. Here, too, they visited sugar plantations, not unlike the plantations that Captain James DeWolf owned in Cuba as well. The sugar was made into molasses, the molasses was used to make rum at the distillery, and the rum was traded in Africa for slaves. It was a neat and extremely lucrative business for the DeWolf dynasty, and it resulted in the deaths and enslavement of thousands upon thousands of Africans. Thomas DeWolf concludes his thoughts about Cuba. "It appears that Cubans are ahead of us in the effort to overcome racism. And in spite of the obvious restrictions in their socialist country, there remains something I can't adequately explain. An odd sense of freedom that we lack in the United States." Thomas DeWolf's family released a documentary some years ago. Perhaps more questions are raised than answers. And he notes in his own book that we are better than we sometimes imagine, and we are not yet all we are capable of becoming. We can remain mired in the mistrust, avoidance, and the distance inherited from previous generations and pass them on to our own descendants. or we can commit ourselves to becoming aware, to listening to each other's stories, embracing the truth, and recognizing and honoring each other's humanity. In doing so, we will finally break through the scars to clean the living wound properly and begin the healing together. I have wondered if my going on several service trips to New Orleans with youth was my own small individual attempt at reparations and for wanting to be forgiven. I have wondered if my outrage at what is happening today, our prison systems, our war on drugs, our lack of gun control, our killing of blacks by police, and so on and so on. I have wondered if this, which all has, of course, racist implications, if this is my own anger from my own shame. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is in another week, and I'm usually not around to do a service then. So that is why I wanted to talk about the trade this morning. But the point that I wish to make is one that Martin Luther King Jr. so often expressed, and which Daniela expressed this morning. Oppression, through institutionalized racism, classism, and sexism, along with our own individual biases and fears and sense of privilege, make us just as oppressed as those over whom we think we have power. And nobody wins, however we try to rationalize or justify it. The bottom line is that the beloved community of which we are part is about right relations, equity and equality, true justice, and love, while privilege is not. So let us untangle the intricate, institutionalized, systemic web of white privilege, which means that we have to in turn look at our economic system as well. Let us create instead a beloved community that truly holds both justice and compassion as that which is one and the same. And may it always be. Amen. So how's that for an uplifting story?